and welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. Today I am speaking to an Australian author who was born to Greek immigrant parents and lives in Melbourne. As a writer, he confronts themes ranging from the social and cultural tensions of modern Australia to faith, sexuality, class, race, and the blights of communism in practice. He's won many awards for his work, including overall best book in the Commonwealth Writers' Prize in 2009, the Australian Literary Society Gold Medal, and was longlisted for the Booker Prize, all for his novel The Slap. He's also a playwright, an essayist, and a screenwriter. His latest novel is a tender, sensual exploration of middle-aged love between two men. It's called The In-Between. Chris, as we last spoke when The Slap had just come out, and that really, in lots of ways, was a life-changing book for you, wasn't it?
Completely changed my life in so many ways. One was, and what I will forever be grateful for, is a material, a financial security, which I never had before, and my partner Wayne too. And I think that's something I don't take lightly, even now, years after, that I think that that was an immense fortune. The other thing that I have talked about is also that relief. I think, you know, my parents have been amazing migrant generation, working class, not of this literary world at all. So there was always a fear and a nervousness about how I was going to survive. You know, they didn't understand it. And I think that's actually the thing I'm most grateful for in terms of The Slap, is that it gave them this sense of relief. He's going to be all right. Mum's been going to this delicatessen for years near where she lives, and they'd all ask about my brother, who's a lovely man, but they're always a bit nervous about asking about me. You know, he's gay, he works in this weird thing called writing. And then she said after The Slap, particularly after it was made into a TV series, they were just going, "How's Crystal? Please say hello." It's such a long time ago now. I do think that I had thought I had found a space. You know, I was working part-time in jobs. I mean, the last job I had, or the job that I had at the end of writing The Slap, was as a vet nurse, you know, at a friend's veterinary clinic. I was doing part-time, and had been working part-time for a long time, knowing that I can't expect to make a living. That's what I thought, from writing. But I want to write the things that I want to write, and I want to write in the way I want to write, and that I will work and make that space possible. And then The Slap changed everything. I didn't have to work. God, even saying that, I can't believe my fortune. I could work as a writer. But then I found myself not knowing what is it that I wanted to write. That was it. And it was actually, you know, just conscious talking to you as someone from the UK. I was really fortunate. I got a residency at a lovely place, Cove Park, in Scotland. I had a beginning of an idea of something I wanted to write, which became the novel Barracuda, but it was actually stepping outside of Australia, being in this astonishing terrain in Western Scotland, and I hope the Scots don't mind me saying that, but feeling an absolute welcoming affinity in that country. It's just suddenly, I just started writing, and I don't think it's an accident that Barracuda is a book about failure, because that was a kind of, what is it, you just suddenly, this incredible thing happens. You have a bestseller, and you don't ever think you're going to have a bestseller. And then you go, what is the purpose of what I'm doing? And what is success and what is failure? And the truth is, as you know, Georgina, that we're always going to be struggling with the demon of self-doubt in what we're doing. I think maybe it was at Cove. I was very lucky. There were other writers there, but there was a wonderful filmmaker, a wonderful textile artist, people that I could sit down in the evening and have conversations with, and I found that elating. And it made me think, oh, just write. This is what you're going to do.
Where is Barracuda set?
Barracuda is set in Australia in the 90s. It begins in 1994 and ends in the first decade of the 2000s, and it's about a young boy, Danny Kelly, who wants to be a world champion swimmer. He wants to win Olympics gold, and he doesn't. And as I said, it's about success and failure, and it's about a working-class kid, Anglo working-class father who's a truckie, his mother is a Greek-Australian hairdresser. He gets this opportunity because of his phenomenal talent to go to a private school here in, which you call public schools. I always get that really.
It's insane.
It is insane. Got to find out the history of that anyway. And Danny fails. And the kind of the centre of the book is the 2000 Olympics, which were held here in Sydney. And he's already knows that, you know, he knows that he can't be a world champion. And it's kind of the spiral that he goes through. What Cove gave me, what Scotland gave me, was the structure for that novel. Danny had very, very much appeared in my consciousness in the way, I don't know, you know, you don't want to get too mystical about it, but I do think I heard his voice. I'd started writing in his voice, but I don't feel like I have a novel until I have a structure. And then it was what I worked on in Scotland when I'm going to tell this story chronologically forward and backwards. So we actually begin with the adult Danny in Scotland, and then alternate chapters, then we see him as a young kid at this high school, private school. And then that chronological playing with time was just what made me excited about writing again.
I think what's really interesting, and I don't think you're alone in this, is that sometimes in order to be able to write about your home, you have to be away.
Oh, God, yeah. I think that is true for everyone, right? I think it's true for whoever you talk to as a writer. But I can only speak of my specific experience as an Australian writer. That sense of what is home? Home is such a contested notion in a place where, one, all of us are dealing, who are white fella, are dealing with the legacy of this was a colonial space, that it was created out of an act of immense violence to the Indigenous people who lived here. On top of that, you have a history of another violence, which was the setting up of a penal colony. So an Irish history, a Scottish history, a Welsh history, an English history.
A Greek history.
A Greek, and that level of violence as well. And then you have an enormous migration that happened post-World War II that my parents were part of and is still ongoing in Australia. And weighing up, well, where is home? What is home? Am I able to call this space home? And really, I think going overseas, travelling, having that fortune, going back to Greece, which is a place I will return to again and again, and I love that place. But and I'm really glad I know the language. But it's not home, you know. I will always be a bit of an outsider in Greece, and I think that was the first kind of trying to come to terms with the idea of home. And that was in a novel called Dead Europe before The Slap that I think I started writing about what that might be, and then yeah, that question of home is. Whether you can say it's belittled my writing or it's been essential to my writing has always been there. I think from my first book, from my first short stories. We haven't seen each other for a while, Georgina. I think a real something that shaped and changed that relationship was COVID, because I was in the UK. Wayne and I were about to celebrate our 35th anniversary, it was, right? And a novel I had written called Damascus had just come out in the UK. I was over to do some publicity, and then we were going to take 6 weeks and travel. You know, we were so excited about it. Within a few days of being in London, however, the world changed. And I remember we were getting the train to Glasgow to go to an event in Glasgow, got a text from people going, the event's not happening. And waking up the next morning and going, we've got to get a flight out. Couldn't get on the phone. The web had crashed. And thankfully, Wayne remembered that we had booked it through a travel agent. And that man saved our lives. I mean, I remember trying to ring the airline, and I just couldn't get through, and then finally did. Their website had crashed, and there was a recorded announcement going, it's a 9-hour wait. Do not hang up, otherwise your call will not be accepted. You know, it was a mad time. I think we've forgotten a bit. All live in a after-COVID world because, anyway, the point of why I'm saying all that is, thankfully, this man got us a flight it was Sunday in Scotland, a flight out of Heathrow on Thursday, and I remember being at Doha Airport and all these people just desperate to get home, and I was sitting across the from a young woman who was getting a flight to somewhere in Africa. I mean, I'm not sure where it was, but she was French speaking and just saying, I want to go home, I want to go home, I want to go home, and crying. And I went, I see what I'm feeling, and home is Australia. Home is this place that's going to accept me. Maybe it's just a matter of passport, maybe it's just a matter of history, but it's also the place I'm... And that has very much stayed with me. Mm-hmm. It was like in that... Because I'm that lucky generation. I haven't been through war like my parents have. I haven't been through civil war like my parents have. I haven't been through hunger and destitution like my parents have. Suddenly, in a crisis, that notion of home didn't become simply an intellectual and existential question. It became a material question. Yeah. What is home?
Yeah. Let's talk about your home, because you live in Melbourne and many of your books are centred there in Melbourne. As you say, you come from a Greek immigrant background, migrant background. And Melbourne seems to me, as a complete outsider, to be a place where you have little enclaves of people from different places.
Again, that's history, Georgina. I think one of the first acts of federation, when before Australia was a nation state, it was a series of colonies, New South Wales, Victoria, Queensland. One of the first acts of parliament was the White Australia policy, that you had to be white and you had to be English speaking to be in this country. A really destructive, awful piece of legislation that, and the complications that it was partly fought for by the Labor Party, because it was about, in their thinking back then, that it was about protecting jobs, right? Anyway, the first assault on that racist policy was the need for immigration that happened after World War II, the sense of, if we're going to industrialise, we are going to need a labour force. So there were start the chinks in the White Australia policy. So we'll first accept Western Europeans and then Eastern Europeans and finally the Southern Europeans and then the middle people from the Middle East and then Asia. And it got, by the late 60s, it no longer applied. But in that industrialisation period, Melbourne was the industrial city. It was where the factories were, which is where my parents worked. It's where industry was. I think that gives you a sense of why it is the city it is. Having said that too, I also think it's not all negative. You know, you could make a negative story about that. What it meant was that it was a truly cosmopolitan city. You know, it became a truly cosmopolitan city because it had people from all over the world and increasingly from all over the world. I mean, I love Sydney, you know, and I have a great fondness for Brisbane as well. And, you know, there's a lot of places that I love in my country, but I think there is something about Melbourne because of that history that makes it, it's never going to compete with Sydney, right? You'd have to be an idiot to go. Melbourne's, you know, it's not a beautiful city, but I think it has a cultural vitality that I really like.
I really, really had a sense of that. It is absolutely vibrant with its museums, with its Wheeler Centre for Writers, and then just this cosmopolitanism where there was every kind of cuisine available and you could get a really good meal. It wasn't just Chinese, it was a specific region of China. Choose anyone you like, that kind of thing.
Well, look, one of the things that, you know, music is a really, obviously reading. I mean, you know, I never did creative writing, but... And I love people coming up to me and going, what should I do to be a good writer? And all I can say is read. Like, that's actually the only... There's no other thing you can say that... I mean, yes, cultivating discipline, you know, whether you do that in a number of words or setting aside time. Of course, they're not unimportant, but I think it's about reading. But I also love music and I also love cinema. And they were two art forms that are really essential to my thinking about how language works. Mm. And what was exciting about being in Melbourne as a young teenager, I was saying to a friend who just earlier, you know, I was 16, 17, and I remember one weekend seeing The Saints and seeing The Go-Betweens and seeing The Birthday Party. And they were all playing in Melbourne. And The Saints and The Go-Betweens, these two outstanding Australian bands who, you know, at the time didn't make the money they should have and didn't have the attention they should have had, but, well, you know, who are now known throughout the world, right? I go to Athens and I have friends with Go-Betweens posters and the same. But they were coming down because Queensland was still ruled by a conservative, quasi-fascist leader. And so Melbourne became this hub of enormous energy in the music world and I think also in the film world. Of course, this was happening in London, this was happening in Manchester, this was happening in lots of places, Mumbai, but I'm talking as an Australian, being in Melbourne at that time as a young kid was really exciting.
And the other thing that always strikes me about Australia, and we're talking on the weekend of Mardi Gras, of course, this huge celebration in Sydney, very much seen as an LGBTQ plus celebration, is the openness towards homosexuality, towards any kind of sexuality at all. And that often puzzles me when I look at results of things like the Voice referendum, for instance, where Australia seems to be in some ways so utterly kind of to the right and in other ways just wonderfully, wonderfully open.
I mean, I think that there is always going to be a tension and a difficulty, and I've called it an immaturity about our understanding of our history when it comes to race and what is land and what is country and what is place, right? And that immaturity has not gone away. It's also, I mean, I was absolutely saddened. I'm not going to say devastated because, you know, First Nations people were devastated by the result. I was saddened. But also at the same time, and it's like I think there were problems of actually talking to communities who came from the non-English world. Like, and, you know, that there's a reckoning that's still going to be reoccurring in this country. And it's not only – and it's a difficult one too, because – very, very different to the way race politics happen in the UK or the USA or say even Europe, you know, the notion of white fella, black fella. So that Indigenous people are the first people, right? And it is about colour, but not only colour. So whatever your heritage is from, if you're not Indigenous, you're going to have to deal with the reckoning. But it's going to be at a slight adjunct to what it is for someone whose heritage is Irish or English or Welsh or Scottish. And we haven't even had the discussion properly about what that means. And so that why I was saddened but not surprised is because I knew the discussion wasn't happening. When it comes to sexuality, I think there's another history going on there, which is a kind of sense of pleasure and hedonism, you know, your English image of what the Australian life is. But it is a culture where the body is, you see the body and the body in all its beauty and its forms everywhere because the sun is, you know, it's hot. And so that relationship of understanding the sensual, I think, is different to what I've experienced in the UK. I'm being very careful here because I don't want to get into generalizations, but I do think that played a part. And also, we had a really, it was the last time I think we had true bipartisanship because that's become almost impossible in the world of politics at the moment. And it was about HIV/AIDS. It was awful at the beginning of the HIV period because there was all the homophobia and the fears. But there was a Labor government was in place full of very smart people. There was an opposition and the health minister who was a true doctor. And actually, their care was not about the ideology. It was about how do we save lives. And I remember feeling like coming to Europe first time as an adult in 1990. England was and the UK was still under the crunch of that Thatcherite period. I went to a gay pride rally in Paris and I was shocked that you couldn't get a condom. Like, and I'd just come from a place that, you know, you as a user of drugs, if you were in Melbourne, you could go to the pharmacy and get a clean syringe because it was a, and that was the last time I think I felt genuine pride. I just thought, oh my God, this place has got some progressive stuff. Yeah. And then One Nation happened, which was a racist party, and there was a turn to the right, and then the anti-asylum seeker stuff happened, and then 2001 in New York, and things went pear-shaped. And I think part of the immaturity that I was expressing before about this country is, and maybe the connection to Greece, having the language and having such a large family there, is to go, shit happens everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I said in a session this week in Adelaide, what is the immaturity of the Australian position? It's the position that says, this is God's earth. And if you don't like it, fuck off, which is right. But it's also, this is the worst place on the planet, which is you can get from the kind of the progressive middle class, you know, and it's like, really? You think you are in the worst place on the planet? You've asked the people of Gaza that? You've asked, I mean, like, you know, the extremity of those two positions to me is an immature response.
Yeah.
You know, place anywhere is complicated.
Let's talk about your new book. Because, but it does follow on nicely because it is basically, it's a wonderful gay love story. And you jump right in there with some very sexual scenes near the beginning. I'm not sure, maybe I'm reading the wrong thing, that I have ever read such a full-on description of gay sex in a commercial novel that isn't shoved away in a niche part of a bookshop.
In a paper bag. you know, what happened was, I started writing, it was Wayne and I had to go into quarantine. I started writing a book called Seven and a Half, which was a book about beauty and a book it was an exercise in what does it mean for me to be a writer? And in the writing of that book, I thought back to the literature that had really made me excited about writing, that had spoken to me. That's Jean Genet, that's Jean Reschy, that is people like Lisa Alther, who I think have been forgotten there. It was, you know, for me, someone like Norman Mailer, someone like Philip Roth, like the French writers, like it's like as a young queer kid in suburban Melbourne, and I was so lucky to get access to those books. I'm really lucky to get access, and they were fearless. And I do think there's something of a loss we have in the culture at the moment because everyone's scared of saying the wrong thing, and I think there are reasons of thoughtfulness, which I understand that, but I think there's also reasons of fear, which is a terrible place for us to be as artists, right? Mm. And so I thought the in-between, I want to write a book about love, which is actually more scary than sex for me. I think love is a much more difficult subject to deal with than sex. And it's a love between two men who are in their 50s when the novel begins. It goes over 5 years, who have been broken in love. And are they going to take that risk again? And I thought, I want to write about sex because that is part of what love is in our relationships. And the other thing that happened amidst all that was that I'd been approached by this wonderful director, Stephen Nicolazzo, to work on an adaptation with a writer, Dan Giovannini, of my first book, Loaded. And I don't read my books again, right? But because I wanted to work with these two wonderful theatre practitioners, I said yes. And I just went, oh, my God, I used to have more courage. I used to not be scared of sex. I used to be curious about the erotic and found that generative. And so, you know, this the process of writing a book is a complicated one, but one of the things very early on with the in-between was that I was not going to let myself be scared of sex.
It's a book about shame.
Shame is part of everything I do. I mean, it was, there's not like a year zero in the writing of a book. I think it's that expression of Doris Lessing's that I've always loved, fugging time. It's the time when it looks like we're just staring off in the distance, but things are percolating there is really important. But there were conversations that happened with the plebiscite on same-sex marriage here. And Wayne and I have been together for so long and we've loved each other and we are absolutely powerful in that love together, you know, and you know, in families that it took, and we are lucky that our families came love us too, you know, but it was a hard struggle. But marriage had never been in our heads, Georgina. It was just, and it was the young people, our nieces and nephews who were, I just went, oh, I'm old. this is a different world and this is a different expression of identity and self, and I'm going to just let them have that space, you know. I'm not going to be that critical, oh, marriage is a bourgeois, you know, that voice. But it did feed into my thinking of the characters in this book, and these are men in their 50s, which, and I'm a man in my 50s, and you can't excise shame and the experience of shame from your body. We came to a sexual life and love through feeling like we were damned if you had a religious background, or that you were lesser than because of what your body was and wanted to express and who you loved and who you wanted to sleep with and all the, and that shame is part of what we carry and what Ivan and Perry carry. I don't think you have to let that shame destroy you, but you have to come to some terms with it. And there's, you know, the things that I'm, that are closest, because these are fictional characters and I'm, you know, it, and I love writing fiction. That's what I learned from Seven and a Half. I want to claim a space for fiction, you know, that that's actually really important. The ability to step in someone's shoes who's not you.
Mm-hmm.
Who's not your, who's not you, Christos Tsolkos, who's not your gender, who's not your, you know, that, let me be an old-fashioned conservative. I would then, I'd prefer to believe in that ability of fiction than not believe in that. So Perry and Ivan are not me, but a close autobiographical moment is that Wayne and I, after all these years, we can't hold hands on public transport because it would feel wrong. It would feel self-conscious. And I love it when I see young girls in the streets where we live doing that, or young boys doing that. But it's just not our history because of the history of the shame. And I talked about it at a session on the festival, a really interesting discussion we had just the other day at our place. And it was myself, it was Wayne, a few friends, a couple who are older than we are, and a few who are much younger than we are. It was about Andrew Haig's, I think, magnificent film, All of Us Strangers, right? And I remember seeing that with Wayne and just crying because I understood that film so well. And then a couple of the younger friends were just going, I don't get that film. Yeah, I think it's a bit homophobic. You know, we're not, I don't get why they, why is he feeling that way and ashamed, and his parents should have accepted him. And Sol, I'm outing you, Sol, I'm sorry, he's my, an older friend, just went, you don't know what it is to carry that in that way. We are never going to let go. We're never going to be able to forget it. We can be released from it. This is me talking now. But I don't think we can forget it.
I think it's a magnificent book. I really do. I think it's fabulous. But there is one great taboo that you also include. Forget the sex, forget anything else. The big taboo that you do address is smoking. Nobody smokes in Australia anymore. You and I are the only smokers in this country, as far as I can see. And in the book, though, Ivan smokes and it's great.
Yes, yes. I mean, you know, I think that... So I've got cousins in Greece who just say to me and friends, Crystal, we're never coming to Australia because we won't be able to smoke anywhere. And I go, no, no, you just have to go to country towns. It's the bourgeoisie that don't smoke. I mean, and one of the reasons it's called The In-Between goes to what we were talking about, sexuality and shame before. These are two men in the in-between of a cultural space. They can't be these young kids who can walk in freedom hand in hand down the street, but they're not old yet. They're trying to make sense of who they are in the world. And part of that is also the in-between of class. So Ivan is a working class man, or what would have maybe easily have been expressed as being working class maybe 30 years ago. But now he's also, where does he fit in class? Is he more middle class? I mean, he's never been to uni, but he's got a business. And I wanted to talk about the in-between of class. And to your smoking, I think there is a tendency of a bourgeois world to say this is correct and this is what we are and this is how we should be. There's some positives to that, but I also think that there is a sense of looking down on people who don't have a similar experience. So looking down at someone like Ivan because he smokes, looking down at someone like Ivan because he may not necessarily vote the same way you do. And you know this, Georgina, as much as, because it's happening everywhere in the Anglosphere. I really wanted to write a book about two people who don't necessarily think the same way and who don't necessarily come from the same spaces and say, yes, you can find love, you can find a common humanity. And not to write it in a sentimental way and not to write it in a glib way, but to actually go, what does that mean to place these two people together and what does it mean for their worlds they come from? And I hope I did that. And smoking is smoking is something that Ivan is struggling with as well. He just, you know, he's a man in his 50s. He knows he's got to be careful, but he wants those 5 smokes a day. And God let him have them.
You really succeeded in everything I think you set out to do in this book.
Thank you.
I just would urge people to read it. Christos Tsiokos, many thanks. The In-Between is published by Allen and Unwin, and it's out now. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the producer, Tamsin Howard. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.